when the sun comes out to shine eternal. I hope the best, but here comes the colonel.
Why are people laughing? It's not funny. It's just not funny. All right, welcome back. The second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network, exploring the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. Today we have with us Dennis Treese. He's the Director of Corporate Security at the Massachusetts Port Authority in Boston. Dennis has been our guest a couple of times in this program, but we've never asked him about cybersecurity, but he's an expert. As a matter of fact, Dennis is a retired colonel with the United States Army, and he secured the Army's extensive telecommunications and computer networks throughout Europe. And so he's going to be with us back again in the second half hour, and we're going to ask him about cybersecurity, because he's a specialist in that. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. But right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set and get into the coin jar and see if we can't get some answers.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
All right, we've summoned the spirit of the fountain. Here we go, O spirit of the fountain. And this is one the old-timers will know. And since you're new around here, O spirit of the fountain, you may not know this, but the old-timers will know it. Who played Tarzan in more films than anyone else? Who played Tarzan in more films than anyone else? And I'll give you a clue. He was also an Olympic swimming champion. Okay? Who was it?
I have given you my now you may tell me.
You have a good memory for movies, O Spirit of the Fountain. But I wonder how many in the audience knew. Who played Tarzan more times than anyone else? Johnny Weissmuller. Yes, the great Johnny Weissmuller. All right, on with our program. Right at the moment, I'd like to ask you a little bit about cybersecurity. I know prior to joining Massport, you were with the Internet Security Systems, and you built and operated a state-of-the-art computer threat operations center. And when you were with the Army, responsible for building the effective detection and emergency response capability to counter all threats to telecommunications and computer systems. And I'm sure that must be a concern where you are, because their Logan probably relies greatly on computer systems. What can you tell us about cybersecurity?
Well, I can tell you that it's a big part of what any security officer does these days. I mean, very often security officers are either physical security experts or cybersecurity experts. I happen to be blessed by having both hats and experience in both. And I can tell you that cybersecurity in this day and age is something that we work on very hard all day, every day. And anybody who doesn't is just ignoring, you know, the realities of the cyber threat. You know, every computer network in the world is under constant attack. And it's not because there's somebody in a basement, you know, somewhere playing around with a keyboard trying to attack you. It's because they put automatic attack software, what we call, they let it loose in the wild. So it's like wolves running around the forest, and anything that is vulnerable to a wolf attack is attacked eventually, and at the speed of light, things get attacked, you know, very, very fast. I mean, I'm convinced that every home computer in America is compromised in some way, and so we don't allow people at Massport, for example, to work on business stuff on their home computer if they're going to bring it, you know, here. We have some secure ways to get into the network on a very restricted basis from corporate machines that are at home, but we don't allow any home computer to come into our corporate network, for example, because they're loaded with these automatic attack scripts, and as soon as you let one of these things into your system, it's going to start attacking your system. And if you are vulnerable to the way the attack has been written in computer code, your machine will be compromised, and it will happen very quickly, and you will not know, because they don't want to hurt your computer. They just want visibility on your computer, and they want to be able to use your computer to launch attacks against other computers. They're called bot armies. Bot is short for robot. So if I can take over your computer, that's now a bot in my army. And typically a bot army can be from 1,000 to 20,000 or 50,000 computers. And then I sell that on the black market. I say, okay, if you want to take down a website, I will rent you my bot army for a week, a month, an hour, whatever. Or I have this many credit card numbers that I've taken off of people's computers, and I'll sell them for a nickel apiece or whatever. So, I mean, that's how the cyber criminals make money these days, and we don't want to be any part of that.
So this bot army is affecting every PC in the country, and they're getting it when they go online to some website or something like that, or how is it infecting these PCs?
Yeah, well, for example, let's say you've got a PC running on Windows XP Service Pack 2, mm-hmm. and you haven't upgraded to Service Pack 3. So any malicious code that is written to attack the vulnerabilities in Service Pack 2, which were fixed by Service Pack 3, but you never decided to install that upgrade, it's called a patch, you will be attacked instantly, because it will query certain parts of your computer, and they'll give the right answer, and then they're in. And they just, you know, and then they will phone home to the mothership and say, I now have this computer. And if there's a further script in there that monitors keystrokes, they'll have all your passwords eventually, because eventually you will type all of your passwords. Or it can just look in your computer for any file that's called passwords. Or it'll look in Internet Explorer caches for passwords. And it's just impossible these days to keep your computers completely clean if you go to the Internet. And oh, by the way, they have infected legitimate websites. So let's say you go to a major corporation website. They don't even know they've got this problem. And you'll click on, let's say it's an automobile website, and you click on, I want to see that model car. You just downloaded some malicious software, and you don't even know it, and neither do the people who own that website. Or people will call and say, you know, I'm calling from this bank, and we know you have an account at the bank. We'd like you to confirm your password. We'd like you to confirm your account number, whatever. Well, people actually fall for that. It's called social engineering, and you ought not to fall for it, because you know what? Your bank already knows your password. They already know your account number. They're never going to call you and ask for that. So you should be suspicious. Or, you know, we got an email the other day. My assistant came in with this thing. She printed it, and it was a perfectly legitimate-looking Bank of America logo and all of that. And it said, you know, we need you to call this number immediately, because there's been some fraud detected on your account. Well, she doesn't have an account with Bank of America. But let's say she had. She might very well call that 1-800 number,
yeah.
which is, oh, by the way, you know, being answered by some criminal who then gets all this information from you, because you got this email that came, and it's got your bank's logo on it, etc. So they're very, very clever. They make an awful lot of money, and they do this from countries where it's not against the law, because not every country has cybercrime law.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dennis, it's been suggested by some that the only way to stop this is to completely rebuild the Internet, or completely rebuild the web and do away with our open access type of way of doing things right at the moment. Do you think that that's the only way we're going to end it, or we're going to continue fighting this war back and forth all the time?
I teach a graduate course in information assurance, and I tell my students that it's time for a do-over. The Internet was developed by military scientists or academic scientists paid, you know, under contract by the military.
Mm-hmm.
And they all were very honest, hardworking people who wanted to share data. And so they created this thing called the Internet. And it absolutely exploded because it's an enormously popular, good idea.
Mm-hmm.
But it was designed from its inception to communicate and with no security protocols whatsoever.
Yeah.
Because it was a trusted community and they just didn't think like criminals. And so it never occurred to them that it would one day be a haven for malicious activity of all kinds and all kinds of activity. And so I'm convinced that we need a separate internet for the financial sector. We need a separate internet for the home entertainment industry. That one would need nothing but copyright protection, right? You don't need, they're not going to have nuclear secrets out there.
Yeah.
Where you have nuclear secrets, you just don't want to be on an internet that some 8-year-old can access.
Yeah.
You just don't want to do it.
Yeah.
Corporations have long had what we call private networks, which are in IP address spaces that are not used on the internet. So, for example, an IP address that starts with 127 or 10 is a privately addressed internet space, and the global internet router system will not deal with it. That's one way of separating yourself from the internet. But as soon as you get, you need to go out to your browser, you need to do a Google search or whatever, you have to get to the internet to do that. And now you have to be assigned an IP address, internet protocol address. It's an internet phone number that is useful on the internet. And when you do that, you can now use the internet, but the internet can also use you. Because when you go out to something, you are establishing a trusted relationship with that distant end.
Okay.
And that's how you get in trouble. If you go to a place that's got malicious software, it now comes right in on the return. So, I think we need to start over. I don't think it's too late. Will it be expensive? It might be. But, you know, I wouldn't let my children walk down an alley that's as dangerous as the internet. And yet, how often do we let our children, you know, be on the internet without supervision? Excuse me. And it's a very, very dangerous place. And so, yeah, I think we need education in our schools. I think we need, you know, to kind of start over and divide the internet up into purpose-built, you know, places with varying levels of security. And so, you know, that would be my recommended solution.
Well, now, who would, I mean, we at the United States started the internet, built the internet, as you pointed out, but, I mean, who would do this rebuild of the internet? I mean, who would take the initiative to do that, and how would we get it adopted, and what's the daunting task ahead of us if we go on that course, and who would make the decision to do it, and all that?
Yeah, that's a great question, and because the answer to that is so difficult and so complex, it's not being discussed and isn't being, you know, worked on. But here's the way I would approach it. I wouldn't ask a government to do it because the government, you know, hasn't been, you know, regulating the internet. I don't think we need that.
Yeah.
But let's say I go out and I invent a new network that I will guarantee that it's secure. It's just kind of like offering, you know, safety deposit boxes. You know, I'm selling you a service, and the service I'm selling you is complete security. And oh, by the way, I offer you all the internet connectivity that you ever wanted. So, would people, you know, go for that? You know, there's a lot of talk about cloud computing, and cloud computing just means that all of your computer hardware is owned by somebody, quote unquote, in the cloud.
Yeah.
You don't know. You don't even know where they are necessarily physically. They have a server farm somewhere. It could be in Mumbai. It could be in Denver. But we call that the cloud. It's just on the internet. You don't control it. You're renting time with it, etc. So if I put a secure internet in the cloud, and sell people who really want security some space on that internet, some time on that internet, maybe people would actually use it. I don't know. I mean, some model, you know, has to come forward, or maybe people don't care. I mean, all evidence points to the fact that today, because, you know, your computer doesn't blue screen, and most people listening to this won't even know what a blue screen is, but it, in the early days, you know, when your computer needed a reboot, it just went blue because it was crashing or whatever, or because somebody sent you some malicious code that caused a blue screen back in, you know, the early days of our, you know, for example, Microsoft software. So people may be just happy. You know, it may be that I'm a computer security guy and I'm all wet. I mean, it may be that we don't really need all this. The fact that, you know, 40 criminals in the Ukraine have your, you know, user ID and password for your bank, maybe you don't care about that because maybe they can't figure out a way to use it. But I do care about stuff like that. I care about, you know, safety and security physically and in the virtual world. And so, you know, if there's a market for it, maybe somebody will build it. You know, it's the backwards of if you build it, they will come. Maybe if there's enough people who will come, you will build it.
Well, yeah, and it's becoming increasingly, people are becoming increasingly aware of these things, and I believe our speaking about it today might help in that education. But your suggestion is that it won't be government that that does it this time. If anybody does it this time, it's going to be a commercial effort. Is that the point?
Well, I think you're going to stand the best chance of success with that, but where government can help is with regulation. You know, it's kind of interesting. We have consumer product safety laws that if you build a bad baby crib and a child dies, you're liable, and you can be sued. But, you know, all of these things, when you get new software, do you ever read what it says when you accept, you know, I accept the conditions of this software? Well, one of those conditions, probably more than one of those conditions, say they make no guarantees at all about the security or the viability or the trustworthiness or whatever of their product. Why do we allow that? If you're going to sell me software, you ought to be, you ought to stand behind it, and you ought to be liable if I suffer because there's some problem with your software. But we don't do that in this country, and I think that's where government can help. I think they avoided it in the early days because they wanted the computer industry to have, you know, enough incentive to grow and develop rapidly. But I think it's mature enough now to where we should mandate that these things be safe. You know, if we mandate that the brakes on your car be safe, why don't we mandate that the internet be safe?
Well, that's an interesting point. Consumer protection for software for the internet.
When you're not on the internet, disconnect from it. I actually pulled the plug out of my router because I've mounted it on the top of my my PC, so that when I'm not actually on the internet, I pull the plug from the internet. It's called an air gap. And, you know, why should I be connected to the internet? And, oh, by the way, if you're not going to do that, when you get done using your computer, turn it off, because you can't penetrate a computer when it's not on. Time to reboot, but it's by far the safest thing to do.
And, of course, when your situation there is security at the Massachusetts Port Authority, that wouldn't protect you from, say, something like Stuxnet or whatever it was that attacked Iran back a few years ago. That was actually smuggled in, I think, wasn't it, in some sort of a Siemens computer or something?
Well, it's been well written about, so I can talk about it. It's we're not sure who actually, wrote the initial code for this thing, but it was designed to go after what we call SCADA systems. And a SCADA system is supervisory control and data acquisition. Imagine a thermostat on the wall of your living room. That's a SCADA device. It gives you information. It tells you what the temperature is in the room. And it also does something. When you move the dial, it sends a signal to the air conditioner to turn on or off based on the temperature that you've got. Well,
sure.
Imagine if somebody in China could access that thermostat and change the temperature in your living room. Well, that's harmless enough, but if they can shut down your electrical grid, that's not harmless. And so the problem with SCADA systems are, you know, when these things, they're just servo mechanisms, right? It's a control center. You push a red button, and 1,000 miles away, a train track changes its direction. And that's an expensive copper wire that goes all the way from you to that servo motor that changes that track.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the internet's basically a free copper wire. So I can link all of my train track, you know, switches to a single console run out of, you know, you name the place, Chicago, and that's a huge saving for my company. Let's call it a railroad company. So that's why these things were done, and they were built by engineers for, you know, operational people, and they weren't built with the idea that some kid in Mumbai or in Duluth could actually be manipulating this thing. So they typically did not have any security controls put on them. And the bad guys know all this, and they attack them when they can. So what we're doing here and what a lot of other companies are doing is a detailed, systematic analysis of all of our SCADA devices to find out, are they on the Internet? And if they're on the Internet, are they on the Internet in such a way that nobody else can use them? And so, I mean, it's just a very methodical approach, because very often folks don't even know what SCADA means, and they wouldn't know one if they tripped over it. So there's an education process, etc. So it's time consuming, but everyone needs to actually pay attention to this problem. But it's just another manifestation of the problem of the overall internet, which is, you know, it's the law west of the Pecos.
So your SCADA systems have got to be monitored and watched pretty closely all the time, especially if you buy any Siemens equipment from Germany, is that right?
Well, that particular malicious software was designed to go after Siemens devices, but I can tell you that it doesn't stop with Siemens devices. You know, they'll go after whatever they want to go after.
All right. That's good stuff. Thanks, Dennis, a whole lot. We really, really do appreciate it. And you're taking out your time from your busy day to be with us. And I understand you're a sponsor, a major sponsor of the Homeland Security Technologies Conference that IEEE is putting on November 15th through the 17th there in Boston, Massachusetts. And we'll look forward to seeing you there. So thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
One word that goes through everything is electricity. And it turns out that electricity is the enabler of being able to get to all these goals. And it's the field of electrical power is such an interesting field today, that although students coming into deciding what to study, my word of wisdom would be get into electrical power, because it is the most rapidly field of electrical engineering that can have huge societal benefits. So if you want a career, something that will be important to society, this is one. My name is Dr. Meyer Sasson. I work for Con Edison in New York City.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.